I'm Brian Tomasik. Many of you may know me. I am currently a researcher on altruism, and I maintain the website Essays on Reducing Suffering. I'll focus on reducing suffering is what I, in the topics that I discuss, but a lot of what I say is more applicable to whatever altruistic cause you're interested in. I'll tell a little bit about my background. I started out as a fairly normal teenager. I played video games and so on. I grew up in near Albany, New York, upstate New York. When I was in eighth grade, in the year 2000, I discovered politics and activism. The main influence was Ralph Nader, who is a American consumer advocate and political activist. He gave a lecture at a local college talking about the importance of working on social issues, being civically active, and making a difference, and the fact that people in Western countries have a big ability to make an influence. So that was really inspiring, and it encouraged me to be interested in political issues. So I began reading about political news, especially left-wing kinds of ideas. And so I was interested especially in poverty and environmentalism during high school. Those views would eventually change, but at the time, that's what seemed most important. When I was in 11th grade, I had a teacher who encouraged his students to write philosophical essays. He introduced us to philosophy, which is not normally taught in high school curriculum. And so we wrote a philosophical essay, 500 words every week, and that got me in the habit of writing essays about these kinds of topics. So I continued the habit even after the course had ended, and I kind of kept a journal where I wrote down essays about things like what I cared about, things like the importance of happiness rather than other more instrumental goals. Things like the importance of doing cost-effectiveness calculations. And I was doing this kind of naively based on general concepts that were discussed. So in 2005, when I learned about utilitarianism, I was interested to see that there was a philosophy that kind of encapsulated a lot of what I'd been talking about already. So when I discovered utilitarianism, I began reading Peter Singer's writings. And I agreed with a lot of what he said, including about donating to help address world poverty, bioethics in general, the importance of cost-effectiveness thinking. One thing that I hadn't appreciated before was his position on animals. In fact, I, at the time, had thought that animals didn't really matter because I wasn't sure if they were sentient, and in general, I hadn't really given thought to animal welfare as a serious moral issue. So when I read Peter Singer, I finally realized that actually this was important, and because of the number of animals, it was maybe the most important issue. And so I soon became vegan at the time and began thinking more about animals. I even began extending beyond what Peter Singer talks about to think about the potential suffering of insects, which was kind of a shock to me when I first realized that insects might be able to suffer just because there are so many of them. Even in the basement of my house, there were spiders eating flies, and to think that that could be causing massive amounts of suffering was a big change to my worldview. And wild animal suffering more generally began to seem like an important topic. Sometimes when people would say that like veganism doesn't make a big difference because there's so much suffering by wild animals, and that should be the suffering of wild animals is just so much bigger, so you can't really make a difference on that. Many people take that as a way to say veganism is not important. I took it in the opposite way to say wild animal suffering is very important. And so I began to think and write more about these issues. In 2006, I wrote to David Pierce, actually, in response to reading his website, and he encouraged me to get a website in his first reply. And So that's the basis of my site, Essays on Reducing Suffering. I uploaded the essays that I'd been writing independently to that site and just have continued adding to that ever since. In around that same time, I began learning about more advanced issues related to altruism, reading Nick Bostrom, Elias Yudkowsky in fall 2006, Overcoming Bias, came along, which later turned into Less Wrong for Yudkowsky's writings. So a lot of those other kind of bigger picture issues also became relevant, and I began thinking about those as well. And so I've continued along these lines ever since. In maybe 2010 or 2011, the effective altruism movement came along and has been growing rapidly since then. And so I've been a main contributor to ideas in that movement as well. And so now I'll talk a little bit about some big picture ideas that I think are important in the areas of altruism, although there are many more details that we can get into with the questions. Whether you're trying to reduce suffering or accomplish something else, there is a lot of uncertainty in our actions. And this is sometimes used as a way to downplay the importance of altruism. People sometimes say, you never know if you're making a positive impact. It's too hard. There's too much complexity in the world. What you think is good might actually be causing harm in the long run. There's a classic example that David sometimes mentions of a priest who reportedly saved Hitler from drowning in a river, thinking he was doing a very good act.
When Hitler was just a sort of kid.
Yeah. Right, when he was a young boy. There is a lot of complexity, but the stakes are also very high. So the fact that these problems are hard is not a reason to simply give up. There are many other areas in science or other kinds of academic domains where the problems are really hard and people spend even decades or centuries figuring out how to best grapple with the problems. But they try it and they eventually make some progress. So I think we can do the same in altruism. But we also need to think carefully about the big picture questions. So just to take an example, there are some things that seem obvious that become less obvious when you think about the bigger picture implications. For almost any altruism cause that you can think of, there are ways that it's good, there are ways that it's bad. And it's sometimes the most paralyzing to weigh the good and the bad because it's not at all clear which one dominates. There are some ways to make it stable, though. For example, one approach advocated by Nick Beckstead is to use common sense as a prior, at least, for how we evaluate something. So the fact that many smart people think that something is good in general is some evidence that it's a good thing. This can fail to work in a few cases. One is if you have sharply different values from most other people. Although you might also have uncertainty about your own values because introspection is only so powerful and you might not properly understand what you would come to value if you thought more and had more experiences. Another reason is that many people, even elites of society, don't explicitly think about the far future and don't consider the far future overwhelmingly important. And so there might be some disconnects between what people think is a good thing in the short term versus what would be a good thing in the long term. And I'll give one clear example of that in a second. So common sense is one way to get stabilization. It's a good heuristic that if you're doing something that almost everybody else thinks is a bad thing, that's probably going in the wrong direction. Or at least you should think very carefully and make sure that there's no compelling reason for going against almost everybody else. There are other ways to stabilize the policies that we advocate. So you can also think about things that are positive sum in terms of helping many value systems and not hurting other value systems in a big way. So when certain policies, like, for example, if you advocated more, if you thought that seatbelts were bad because they cause more meat consumption or something, or there's a parallel case in for world poverty. Some people are afraid that reducing world poverty will increase meat consumption as people become richer. So when you hold a stance like that, you're in opposition to the values of many other people who care a lot about seatbelts or care a lot about reducing world poverty. And so that's one signal, sort of like common sense, but in this case, it's just another way of looking at the fact that there's potentially a problem with what you're advocating because it's contingent on what kinds of values you hold. Whereas if you work on something that's positive sum for many value systems, then there's more confidence that what you're doing is a good thing because, it's not contingent on what values you happen to hold. And it's, it's also something that people can get behind in a mutual way. So, when you do something that, encroaches on what other people care about, they're, going to be angry and they might, care less about what you care about. But if you can work on something that lots of people care about, they may also do something that you care about. So there's reciprocity in what you work on. And when you work on something that helps many value systems, other people are more likely to appreciate that and maybe reciprocate. So it can even be beneficial for what you care about to just help others even without helping your own cause specifically. So those are some stabilizing heuristics that can help us select causes. Look for something that's at least consistent with common sense and that helps many value systems at once without hurting certain value systems too much. Some things that I think fall into this category of fall into these constraints are promoting cooperation, both at a personal group and international level, promoting wisdom and reflection and greater awareness of philosophical issues, and in general, creating political structures, social norms, group dynamics, other kinds of social technologies that better improve society's ability to handle challenges and figure out important questions in ways that are good for many parties. And then a third thing that seems fairly robustly positive in the sense is to do meta-level activities that further the previous two. So for example, building a movement of people who are interested in effectiveness and these kinds of robust positive interventions would also presumably be a pretty robust thing, especially since that movement can then be directed to many different causes depending on what seems the most important. This is the basis of the Foundational Research Institute that I and some others in Basel founded. The goal is to explore these crucial considerations for altruism and think harder about what is the best place to have an impact, or even make sure that what we plan to do is positive. I don't think there's necessarily a single best place to have an impact. There might be many that are important depending on your skills and interests, but at least to identify some high impact and likely robust areas to make a difference. So I'll talk more about the two things I mentioned before, cooperation and wisdom. I'll start with wisdom, and this is an example where I think there may be some divergence between short-term and long-term thinking. So it's common to see people encourage faster technology growth as a way to improve society, and that makes a lot of sense in the short term because technology can solve a lot of problems. I mean, there's in vitro meat to help displace factory farms. Technology tends to improve wealth overall, which includes reducing poverty. Technology improves quality of living in many ways, more powerfully than perhaps anything else. So there's a lot of potential in technology, and it seems like you want to get more technology as fast as possible because people are in poverty, animals are in factory farms, and it's really important to improve things. This even applies for the suffering of animals in the wild. With faster technology, we would be sooner able to help wild animals, potentially. But there's also risks of technology, and there's even the possibility of locking in certain suboptimal outcomes for the long term. One example is with AI. It's possible that AI will be built to have stable goal preservation, in which case the way that you construct it now could matter for billions of years into the future and could expand to the whole galaxy. And so what matters more than how fast we build AI or how fast we develop technologies in general is how wisely we develop AI or technologies. A little bit of improvement to the quality of the outcomes that we produce, if they're stable for the long term, would be vastly more important than having it 100 years sooner or even 1,000 years sooner. And this is the basic point that Nick Bostrom makes in his Astronomical Waste paper, where he argues that in the end, the safety of the future matters more than the speed. And he was talking specifically about extinction risks primarily in that piece, but I think it applies actually more importantly for, especially for those who want to reduce suffering, to other qualities of the future, like how much suffering it contains, how cooperative it is, and these other kinds of things that could matter a lot besides just extinction. There's a big difference between a totalitarian future and a cooperative, nice future. Maybe even a bigger difference between no future and a cooperative future. So what we do now can potentially have a big impact for the long term. In this case, it's clear that just getting to AI or getting to other technologies as fast as possible may not be the best thing, because society needs more time to develop wise political structures, social norms, institutions, general understanding to better grapple with challenges that come forward. And so what I would encourage is what Luke Mellhauser and Anna Salomon coined differential intellectual progress, where you try to selectively push faster on things like wisdom, cooperation, political sophistication, and other kinds of social technologies rather than, and also kind of intellectual progress in domains that reduce risks of suffering. They said just risks in general, but I would focus on risks of suffering, rather than promoting technologies or ideas that expand like human power and ability to manipulate the planet, which need to be thought about carefully before they become available. This is an extension of the original concept of differential technological development that Nick Bostrom coined, which is basically the same idea that you want to advance the risk-reducing technologies before the risk-increasing technologies. So certainly some technologies are probably good. I mean, like certain aspects of the internet vastly improve the ability of people to learn and communicate and like network on important issues and things like that. But many other technologies are risky, including the pace of software that or even Moore's Law hardware that accelerate the possibility of AI, neuroscience that accelerates the possibility of AI and better understanding of how to build general AI. And even things like nanotech that can be destabilizing to the international system with the advent of nanotech weapons and things like that. In general, technologies are destabilizing, so it seems at least a priori that you might want to take it slower and have more time for social control. Like, governments are generally very slow compared to the private sector, and you need some government intervention to solve prisoners' dilemmas or tragedy of the commons situations that would otherwise result from just market forces. So from that perspective, it seems important to take things slow. Of course, there are some who argue the opposite and say with faster technology, we would have faster ability to develop countermeasures. And that's certainly a consideration as well. Like, technology as a whole is not a uniform entity in this regard, but there are some that are positive, some that are more negative. So that's certainly a valid consideration. And so the sign of promoting technology is not totally clear, but like I would be wary of assuming that it's positive, and I might in general assume that at least I don't want to actively support technological progress as a whole. Although I also wouldn't actively oppose it. I think we should just kind of selectively push on social angles more than technology. This also raises questions about economic growth. For example, economic growth advances technology, and so from that perspective, it might seem risky, though there are also many other benefits, like the fact that trade improves international cooperation. In general, economic growth improves moral values and tolerance, and civility toward outgroup members. Economic growth also improves the good technologies and education, all those kinds of things. So economic growth is even less, is kind of a double-edged sword in that way. And I don't really have a good opinion on the sign of promoting GDP as a whole. But there are better things to push on that are clearly positive. In general, as I mentioned, I think a good heuristic is that the social sciences are kind of safer than technology. And they're kind of maybe the most important areas to focus on in general. Things like international cooperation, political science, like social norms, psychology of group dynamics, and like politics of democracy, good governance, like ability to respond to social challenges. Those kinds of things are kind of the first step that you would imagine for altruism, because science or technological advances can come later once we have a better handle on working together and doing things that are positive for humanity. So, science may be important to study somewhat to inform us about the kinds of possibilities that are out there and the kinds of things that we might need to look out for. But in terms of things to push on right now that move move society in better directions for the far future, it seems as though the social side of things is generally safer and more urgent. Now I'll talk a little bit more about cooperation specifically, which, as I said, is another intervention that seems fairly robustly positive. In particular, a lot of the opportunities here are in the realm of international cooperation. This is important for solving global coordination problems, which will become especially prominent as technologies develop. In general, with technology, whether AI or nanotech or biotech or anything else, there's the possibility for arms races where one country or one company races against another to build the technology faster and faster. And when you're trying to develop the technology first, you have less time and you're less interested in things like what are the potential risks, what are the potential long-term consequences, will this cause suffering in the future? You don't really have time to think about how to reduce risks of suffering. You might also, in the case of, say, AI or nanotech, you might focus on military applications of the technology to the exclusion of more socially beneficial applications. And so the whole development on the technology may move in a different direction when there's a competitive dynamic at play. Certainly competition can sometimes be good as well, like in the marketplace when companies compete for better products, consumers benefit, and so on. But in the case of especially international competition or even competition among companies without concern for risks, or like the externalities, both to society in the short term and especially to the far future, then you've got more of a concern about the need to have coordination to prevent those problems. So one specific scenario you could imagine is, say, an arms race between the US and China to build AI first, or even military robotics or nanotech weapons or something of that sort. So that's maybe not overwhelmingly likely. There's hope that, especially given the strong trade between the US and China, that they will remain cooperative for the long term. But it's a possibility that one could imagine. So things like that are the kinds of scenarios that we should be thinking about and also thinking about how to avoid. One of the main benefits of cooperation that I talked about is the fact that you can take things slower and have more time to think about the risks and think about how to design it so that it's best for many value systems, not just reducing suffering, but also other things that people care about. And there may be significant opportunities to reduce suffering and do things that other people care about if you have the time and the reflection to figure out how to do that. And another benefit of cooperation is the fact that you can, the fact that when you choose a compromise point, you can get, each side can get more of what it wanted than it would have gotten in expectation from a race. So for example, if there are two parties that each have a 50% chance of winning an arms race, they have a 50% chance of getting what they want or else they lose. With compromise, in general, values are not in total opposition to each other. So it's possible to devise an arrangement whereby each side gets, say, 65% of what it wants, and that's better than 50% in expectation if they race. So there are also there's also kind of a surplus from compromise that's due to the fact that you can, most values are not completely parallel, and you can usually give different values a lot of what they want in some sort of negotiation. One example, sort of a fanciful example, but maybe it'll become relevant in the farther future, is between the value of reducing wild animal suffering and the value of having natural ecosystems preserved. So naively, they seem to be in opposition, like every ecosystem that's preserved is additional wild animals that are suffering there. But you could imagine ways to make it not completely in opposition. So, for example, maybe the people who want to preserve ecosystems care somewhat about species diversity. And so as long as you preserve each species, then they might not care if you reduce the numbers of certain species that are very populous. They may also care more about the big majestic animals, for example, rather than all the insects, or they might want diversity of ecosystems, but they don't care about how much you have, or even more speculative long-term things, like maybe they would be okay with re-engineering the animals not to suffer as much, or introducing robotic animals that can shut themselves off when they're being eaten so that they don't suffer during the process of predation, or various other scenarios that you can imagine. So those are ways that you could potentially give the nature people some of what they want without causing nearly as much suffering. So that could be better in expectation for both sides than trying to completely eliminate nature, which is likely to turn off the other side and arouse opposition and make them even less likely to be sympathetic to your views if they happen to win control. So that's an intuition of where you can get benefits from compromise, like the surplus from splitting in the middle. And then there are other important side effects of compromise as well, like the ability to control rogue actors who might be doing things that you didn't want. Just the general heuristic that, like, world peace and cooperation is generally a very it is almost universally shared as a goal, and so it seems unlikely to be overturned by some consideration that you didn't think of. And also the fact that many people appreciate cooperation. It's a very positive sum thing. And so the fact that you're promoting cooperation is in itself a way to cooperate. It's a way to do something nice for others. And so they may look more favorably on your values. They may be more inclined to help you in the future with what you care about. So those are the two topics I was going to mention. There are many other things that that are on my website or that I'm glad to discuss. One other thing that has been talked about before is wild animal suffering. Ruri gave a talk a few days ago, and I mentioned that I think it's unwise to advocate like wholesale destruction of nature to reduce wild animal suffering, but rather an approach that is less invasive makes more sense. So, for example, I think the maybe the easiest way to approach the issue is to focus on future suffering, like spreading wildlife into space, where humans might multiply wild animal suffering many times what's currently on Earth if they spread life into space. And in addition, you don't have a lot of the problems that you have with destroying ecosystems on Earth. For example, you can, on Earth, people rely on ecosystems for oxygen and medicines and various, agriculture, life-sustaining activities. So there are concerns about interfering there. There are concerns that, for example, certain sorts of environmental degradation, like climate change or even topsoil loss or water shortages, could lead to more international instability, more conflict, and so on. And then many people care a lot about existing ecosystems, but they don't have quite the same passion for creating new ecosystems of the same type. And so it's a lot easier to convince people that it's maybe not such a great thing to spread wild animal life. In fact, if you ask people whether they would create wild animal life on another planet from scratch, they often say they don't really care or even that they would be opposed to it because it would be interfering with the uninhabited ecosystems on those planets. So that seems potentially a more a less abrasive way to frame the issue and may have more payoff in the long run anyway. I'm also interested in the suffering of insects. As I mentioned, it was a revelation to me to realize that insects might suffer. And I still think their potential suffering is very significant. There are a billion insects on the planet, so almost a billion insects for every human. And so there's some people say that they might count less because they're simpler and they have a much smaller brain and so on. And I agree that they probably count less than humans, but I think there's some argument to be made that they count at least more than their number of neurons would suggest because they're autonomous agents and they have their own utility functions. To themselves, they matter. To an individual insect, it matters more than anything else. It is the whole world to itself. And insects may also have more efficient brains. Like when you've got a much bigger brain, you don't need to worry about optimizing every neuron. Insects fly and have lower metabolic consumption, so they need to be more optimized for efficiency. They may also have more neurons devoted to hedonic operations. So for all those reasons, they may count a lot more than their proportional number of neurons. And even if you're counting raw neurons, it seems like there are more insect neurons on the planet than human neurons, at least by one or two orders of magnitude. So there are potentially realistic ways that we could address insect suffering. One that I've mentioned is humane insecticides, the idea of developing chemicals or other methods that kill insects with the same effectiveness but in a more quick way or using some mechanism that's less painful. I'm not sure if reducing insecticide use as a whole is a good thing because insecticides also keep insect populations down and prevent a lot of natural births and deaths. So I don't want my position to be mistaken for thinking that we should just favor organic farming. In fact, organic farming is sometimes worse than conventional farming because it uses natural predators that probably kill in a very painful way. Evolution should have optimized insects to find predation extremely painful. In general, organic farms have very high insect densities on the fields. So I'm not suggesting that organic is the way to go, but that developing more humane conventional approaches could be a realistic intervention that we could do to help insects. So I think I'll stop there, but there are many more topics, so I'm glad to talk more.
If you had $1 million to spend, where would the million go?
Well, I guess if it was totally usable without restrictions, I would probably save most of it for myself just because that's the most flexible strategy of all. If it had to be donated to an organization, I would probably choose Foundational Research Institute because that's flexibly going to choose important areas to work on and address these big picture questions. And even if there were excess funds, in the worst case, we could just move them to whatever cause we thought was important. Other causes that I think are important in the short term include the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, or MIRI. They do important work on philosophy and cooperation in the future. And so I think they're reasonably important in that respect. I don't necessarily agree with them on their values or all the things that they work on, but I think on balance, the work they do is important enough that even if I only agree with some subset of it, it can still be very effective.
I suspect you'll actually want to qualify one of your statements. You said society today is comparatively humane. If one thinks that probably the greatest source of severe and readily avoidable suffering in the world today is factory farming, the fact that non-human animals need to be declawed, tail docked, castrated, and all these terrible things to prevent them mutilating themselves and each other suggests an extraordinarily high level of distress. Though in one sense, yes, Pinker is right in his book Better Angels of Our Nature. Clearly, in many respects, our civilization is pretty barbarous by post-human standards.
Well, if you also include wild animals, then the world may have less suffering now than it did at any time in the recent memory. Humans have displaced a large amount of land. There are trends also to reduce factory farming and be more concerned about that. Although you're certainly right that the trend is more in relative terms and also from a human perspective. But it's certainly plausible that as society develops more technologies, there will be more examples like factory farming of suffering that is caused by our technology that we don't care enough to avert, or that we have other priorities, and so it's not reduced as much as we'd like. One example that I mention in some of my pieces is suffering subroutines, the idea that the reinforcement learning algorithms and computations of future civilization would probably involve suffering because that's a pretty instrumentally valuable property for an agent to have. So robots or intelligence workers like scientists and engineers and so on of a future civilization might suffer routinely. And just because of the sheer magnitude of how many of them there are, both because of cosmological scales as well as the greater efficiency of digital sentience, you would probably multiply suffering many times. But I think that's I think it's likely that future civilization will vastly increase suffering relative to what we see on Earth now. But the bigger issue is how much suffering there is. I think like with the wild animal issue, or like with any other issue, you don't push for perfection, you push for the best you can do. And I think if we can at least address these issues and kind of have a relatively peaceful future in which we have social institutions that allow for different parties to push for their interests, then there's much more space to reduce those kinds of suffering than if you have just somebody building the first AI and not thinking at all about suffering subroutines. That could have many times more total suffering. So, like, the kinds of things that I was talking about offer the scope to reduce suffering substantially, even if not get it to zero, even if not get it to less than we see today. So I think we should focus more on avoiding the bad scenarios and making it pretty good rather than trying to get the best and probably making things worse in the process by alienating others.
What are examples of possible interventions to increase or stabilize international cooperation?
So a lot of organizations work on this already. As I mentioned, arms control seems like a pretty good template. Global governance is another. So in general, the idea of global governance seems pretty important as a goal, as a long-term goal, because you can... Thomas Hobbes wrote about this in the Leviathan, where he said, the state of nature is a war of all against all, but if you have a Leviathan that can enforce cooperation, essentially, and be a higher power that allows for contracts and positive sum arrangements to be enforced, then you can then everybody can benefit. And so the same thing potentially applies in the international sphere. International relations scholars say that the international scene is still an anarchy, basically, because there's no ultimate power. There's nobody to help you if you're getting invaded. To some extent have, for example, the United States that may intervene and act somewhat as a global superpower to help stabilize or destabilize, as the case may be. But we don't have any formal structures, and there's no guarantee of protection the way that we have police for within country protection. So that seems pretty important for a lot of these issues that we're talking about, because when you have a higher authority that can protect and kind of enforce the laws, then you can start doing contracts. Like, you can start making deals, you can start enforcing those deals in a more robust way. The concern with arms control arrangements, for example, is if your partner defects, then you're at a loss because they're now ahead of you, and there's nobody to undo that crime, basically. It's hard to make binding arms control agreements, and in fact, in the nuclear case, it rarely happened that nuclear technologies were actually constrained by these agreements, because you're just worried that the other side is developing something in secret and you can't tell, and you don't want to find yourself in a position where they were doing that and you trusted them. So if you've got a robust international community that can help to maintain, like, international laws and agreements, then that problem would be reduced. There's also issues of transparency. Improving transparency should be pretty important going forward, because already we have problems verifying compliance with nuclear arms control, and nuclear weapons are very big and generally visible, the construction, whereas things like nanotech weapons or AI are can be done in very small places using technologies that look very harmless. So especially in that case, it becomes more and more important to have transparency, and we need to figure out how to allow for international transparency and, like, robust inspections where you can verify at will without violating civil liberties too much. Other things that are important are more of a kind of psychological or sociological angle, things like the value of internationalism, where you see yourself as a citizen of the world instead of a citizen of a country, because a lot of the reason for arms races in the first place is because one country wants to beat the other. But if if everybody didn't care what country they were part of, then there wouldn't really be motivation for that. And especially now, like the US and China have relatively similar values, at least compared to the US and the Soviet Union. So like in the limit of an internationalist mindset, you wouldn't care as much if China beat the United States, for example. That can also just improve interest in global governance, because a lot of times nationalist sentiments resist international institutions because they don't want to interfere with our autonomy and all those kinds of things. So having more appreciation for the importance of international governance would help make those arrangements actually work. Then other things in general that help with both general cooperation as well as international cooperation are tolerance of other values, other cultures, other ways of thinking. There's evidence that literature can help get inside other people's minds. This also increases compassion in general, not just cooperation. Things like exchange with other cultures in terms of transferring cultural artifacts can reduce kind of xenophobia. Having people exchange in terms of like visiting other countries or having conferences between countries. And David Pierce made an interesting proposal about female governance. He was wondering whether if women ruled the world, there would be more peace. I think that's that's not going to happen, but we can empower women to have more power in their countries, and that might reduce violence. Although there's also, you need to be aware of game theory and aware of the constraints of reality. So, for example, if the United States unilaterally got rid of its nuclear weapons or something, that could potentially make things worse because it would destabilize deterrence equilibria that have existed for a long time. And more generally, there are a lot of realities of power politics that you need to be conscious of when you're designing these strategies. So, like, even naive peace movements may need some modifications to make sure that they're actually advocating something valuable. Certainly, the spirit of peace movements is good. And then, if we can channel it in the right directions, that's a good outcome.
Yeah, perhaps I should just add, I don't actively campaign for all female governance because I don't think it's sociologically realistic. It's almost impossible to get anyone to consider it purely as a technical measure in the same way one does drink driving laws. But it was just a throwaway thing that Hank Felicia wrote up for an article. Yeah,
I think the very marginal step is the more realistic one, where you improve female education and empowerment in various countries, and in general, the ability of women to have an impact on the political process.
Do you want to comment on some questions that the Foundational Research Institute might work on, or that you'd advise other people to work on if they were interested in doing so?
Sure. What are some dominating future scenarios? For example, what kinds of AIs are likely... Will it be a single AI that goes foom on its own, or will we start with whole brain emulation, or will we start with like a more distributed AI that's shared by many parties that can affect where we try to influence? If we think that it's going to be an individual AI, then individual AI developers may be more important to to reach with our messages. It also matters whether AI is developed by companies or governments or individuals. If it's developed by governments, then international cooperation becomes more important. Governance structures are important regardless, because it seems as though you need some sort of way to manage who builds AI and who gets to decide how it happens. Other questions that are relevant include exploring scenarios for aliens. What kinds of values would they have? How many are there? Are we likely to interact with them? My guess is that on average, aliens would be less. We would like alien values less than our own because we come from our own values, but it's not clear how much less. And certainly, there's value in kind of not just multiculturalism, but kind of expanded multiculturalism, where you can appreciate values very different from your own. I think moral cooperation and tolerance is important, like understanding where people's values come from and what leads people to be more tolerant of others. There's a lot of social psychology and social moral psychology research in like where our intuitions come from. And one hypothesis I have is that as people think more about the determinants of their values, they'll be more open to seeing the arbitrariness of their believing this instead of that. And so there may be more opportunity for people to respect each other because they can see, like, this genetic property or the fact that I had this experience as a child is the main reason that I feel this way instead of some other way. So that could potentially encourage tolerance as well. Then there are some other kind of meta questions about like the best strategy to use, whether we should do more movement building or more research, epistemological questions. How certain should we be about what we believe and our foundational assumptions versus how seriously should we take very strange views that other people hold? Many more questions. And then there's a set of questions in wild animal suffering as well that are relevant to reducing wild animal suffering in the short term. Although, as I mentioned, I think it's also important to focus on preventing the spread of wild animal suffering.